You're listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more.
This is your host, Simon Scriver, but I'm on holiday at the moment, so here is guest host Sam LaPrade and Clay Buck.
Clay Buck.
Good morning, Sam.
I'm so excited to be here with you.
I'm excited to be here with you.
Well, we're here because our incredible friend, Simon Scriver, is taking a much-deserved vacation.
And well-earned one.
Absolutely. And we're here, and he, of course, has this incredible podcast. It is like the incredible, amazing, awesome Simon Scriver podcast. Is that what it's called?
It's Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast.
Fantastic.
See, there's a lot of adjectives there I can't live up to.
I'm just so happy you're organized.
I have a thing called the Google.
Google. We love the Google.
We do.
And I'm going to tell everybody a big, giant secret. I feel like this is something everyone wants to get really close to. Maybe turn the volume up.
A little romantic music in the background, maybe?
A little bit. I need to tell everyone that I totally fell in love with you.
Oh.
100%.
The feeling's mutual.
Do you know why?
Tell me why.
You had me at data.
It's true. You had me at data. It's true. Yes.
And we met on Twitter.
We did. Do you remember how and why we first connected?
Remind me.
Some quick Twitter exchange. And I'm like, hello, who is this fascinating Sam person? And then I go to your website. And the first thing I see is database audits. And I just went head over stupid heels and went, yes. You're speaking my love language now.
I know. It's true. Because there is a love language in fundraising. And I think it is data. And there's another one, which we both agree on, too, which is storytelling.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I don't know. For what it's worth, I always say I'm a fundraiser living at the intersection of good data and great storytelling.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I try, you know.
So you and I have had this virtual relationship, but we haven't met in person, which surprises a lot
of
that know both of us. They can't believe we actually haven't met in person.
Right, I know. And I sometimes forget we haven't met in person.
I know, me too, actually.
Which we have to rectify this. The universe is conspiring to keep us apart, and that's ridiculous. We will find a time.
Yeah, I'm coming to San Diego in October.
I am planning on being there, God willing, and the budget allowing.
Oh, my heavens. Can you imagine? We need to have people witness the first time we actually meet.
I think we should do that. There's the list of people that are going to be at that storytelling conference, the speakers, is amazing. And you know me, I'm a conference junkie. Right. I have shared with you my conference jacket with all of my old pins and labels and all of that. And I love conferences because just like this, like you draw so much energy from it and you get to meet great people and all of that. There's something really special. I know this isn't a plug for it, but there's something really special about the storytelling conference.
Absolutely.
There's an energy there. It's that curated sort of content and everybody revolving around one theme. It's really kind of wonderful.
And what's really funny, just completely ironic, is that I am speaking at it and my title is Storytelling with a Data Twist.
Right. And I cannot wait to hear what you're going to talk about because that's not easy, honestly. Right. Because you can talk about great data and you can talk about data, but how does data inform how you segment? How does data inform what story you tell and to what audience? And there's an art to it and there's a science to it. So I am looking forward to learning at the feet of the master.
Oh, I'm really excited about it, too. So tell me, what is your biggest data thing that drives you the most crazy, your biggest pet peeve about data?
It's hygiene and quality. Mm-hmm. Right. And so whenever I talk about data, I always start with this story. I failed college algebra 3 times. Yay, me. because I was a theater major. and this is where my brain goes is, you know, very much into, I'm not math generated at all. I'm not math focused at all. This is not my natural wheelhouse.
Guess what? So, me either, by the way.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So to me, the thing about data is it's often thought of as, it's the realm of the data geek. It's the realm of the math nerd. It's, there's a lot of pejoratives that are put on data. I'm not a data person. I don't like it. Well, here's the thing. I had to get good at it, especially early in my career when you're a one-person shop and you're watching all your letters come back or, whatever it is, the data's not getting. So I had to get good at it. So, I mean, I can run a mean pivot table in Excel and I can sort and filter and that's about it. And if I can approach data, then I think anybody can, right? So I take that viewpoint from it that it's not hard. It's absolutely critical to good fundraising. And with just some simple techniques, you can truly revolutionize what you're doing. So you asked me what my biggest pet peeve. It's data quality, because this is a simple thing to keep on top of. If you don't have the email addresses, if you don't have the addresses, if your data is going bad, which it always will, who are you fundraising from? How are you getting that story to the right people? You can have the most beautiful, gorgeous, compelling, wonderful, perfect story in the world, and if 20% of your file isn't reaching its destination, or your portfolio of major gift donors you don't have phone numbers for, what are you doing?
Absolutely.
And I think, sorry, you got me on the rant, man.
No, go.
It's what I do, right? And I think as an industry, I see so much focus on, we need new prospects, we need new major gift donors, we need new donors. Well, you've got a file of donors, people that for whatever reason are already in your wheelhouse, and you're not reaching them because the data's bad, but you're focusing your energy on going and getting new donors. Now let's talk about the ones you have, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's really crucial. I do a whole session on fishing your own pond,
because I think that's
really important that people realize. I run data audits for people all the time, and they'll have 100,000 donors and 10% are giving.
Right.
But they're worried about, sort of acquiring new donors, which I get why. But at the same time, fishing your own pond, find out what else you have.
I love that. I love the title. You're absolutely right. I try to split that line between so much advice is given to organizations assuming they already have a robust database. Side story. A printer was recommended to me. I was having a hard time finding a printer to do our direct response that I really liked. And, called him and had an investigatory conversation. And he kept driving me on, your lapsed donors, your house file, the folks you already have. And I kept saying, dude, we have like 500 donors for this organization. So there isn't a house file there. So there's a data approach for organizations that really do need to acquire new donors. But for the most part, it's already there when you just look at it. You know this from data audits. When you just look at it, the quality just isn't there. You can't reach them. But these are people that gave. They're people that engaged with you, 1,001 stories, I could tell. My most recent rant, a friend and colleague was looking to take their organization fully digital, right? So they wanted to really expand their digital outreach. Fine, we can, the topic of digital versus direct response is a whole other podcast and a lot of stuff on that. Absolutely, digital is not responding as well as direct response, but that's a whole other thing. But they wanted to go fully digital, so we ran a database audit. Out of 13,000 records, only 6% had actual email addresses. Exactly. And then when you looked at their click-through and open rates, it was even worse. So you're raising $1.5 to $2 million a year with what you're doing now. You want to raise more, so you're going to go digital, but you have no email addresses.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, so I always say, it's not about being data-driven, it's about being data-informed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's a really good point, because when we look at databases, certainly through our lens, one of the very first things I look at is second gift conversion rate.
Yeah.
And to your point, when you talk about click-throughs and that kind of thing, it's hard enough to get someone to even open the mail or email,
right?
Mail or email, and then to actually get them to take action. So that second gift conversion rate would even be lower for that kind of organization, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What's the biggest thing that you see? What's the biggest issue you see when you do a database audit?
I think for me, it's second gift conversion is a huge piece, because when we always talk about, I remember I spoke in San Diego, I think in about 5-6 years ago, and I talked about how the first gift actually isn't the most important gift.
No.
I can get anybody to give me $100, right? You tell a certain story, you can really kind of, you know, empower a lot of people, especially things like, you know, through events or peer-to-peer fundraising, you can get people to do that kind of non-traditional fundraising in terms of more of a event type stuff. For me, it's taking an actual philanthropic donor and having a second gift for them. I always say to myself, and I say to my clients all the time, donors speak to us through the data.
Yes, yes,
yes. They want to us when they only give us one gift.
Yes.
They actually speak volumes, right?
Absolutely.
You're listening to that. Secondly, I think donors say a lot when they say that they've left a gift in the will, when they've given 10 years of consecutive giving, when they become a monthly donor. So if we're not sort of listening to that and second gift conversion, like every time I get a report, we have 27 different sort of views of the data. The first one I always flip to is second gift conversion.
Interesting.
It speaks to stewardship. It speaks to all of that. It speaks to the health of an organization very, very quickly.
Well, and it speaks to your story, right? So you told them a great story one time and they gave, right? Now you've told them another great story and they gave again.
Right.
So there's a lot of strength behind that. I like that. That's cool.
Absolutely. And I think that's really a piece. The other piece that I look at, of course, is RFM. So recency, frequency, and monetary. So how recent have they given the gift? We want that bar to be really nice and tall. We want all our gifts, of course, to be most recent. Frequency of gifts. How many gifts are those one-time gifts like we just spoke about? And how many people are giving two times? And how many people are giving three plus? And we want that to be nice and big because we want our monthly giving to be nice and strong. And then, of course, monetary. How many people are giving under $100? Not that they're not important donors, but we just really need to make sure we've got a nice diversified portfolio in terms of who's giving. We need people at every level of giving, and you cannot raise all of your money off $20 or $50 or $75 gifts.
No, you can't. I'm going to push back a little on RFM with you. So, and you know, I've spent a fair amount of time in the prospect research space.
Yeah.
Predictive modeling and data analytics and all of that. And again, I am not the guy, right? I'm not the analyst. I need somebody who goes and does the complex stuff and then gives it back to me and I can interpret it for you. So I'm pushing back on RFM, not because it's not valuable. It is. It's extremely valuable. But, okay, so most CRMs don't calculate RFM for you, right? There's usually not, I haven't seen that in a lot of CRMs, relationship management databases, which means it's on the individual person, the individual fundraiser to calculate RFM, which means they've
You're good.
And now we devolve into why Sam and Clay giggle together.
Yeah.
Right, so they've got to get a lot of information out in order to calculate RFM. It's not hard, right? You can do it in Excel pretty easily, relatively straightforward, but you got to kind of know what you're doing and what data you need to do it. And my thing is, if you can't do quick and simple analytics, you can either, as a frontline fundraiser, spend all of your time doing analytics and measuring, or you can use the information you're getting and go out and fundraise. So how do we make it simple? I love RFM. It's a great tool. If it's difficult to measure, which I often find it is for especially for smaller shops who don't have a full-time database admin, that's why I love lifetime value.
Right.
Because lifetime value will get you close to what an RFM will measure. But looking at that lifetime value of donors tells you so much, not just about that individual donor, but your file overall.
Right.
So if you're seeing high lifetime values, if you're seeing that kind of robustness throughout the file, then it tells you something good. If it's low, and then the next question is, what's high, what's low? Well, it's comparative based on the file, but some sort of overall metric that gives you a number of how are the donors behaving.
Yeah, right? No, absolutely. And I think that long-term donor value, to your point, is really crucial. I have many, many people after they've done a report with me say, which one should I show my board? And I say, if you only show them one, show them long-term donor value.
Yeah, agreed.
One of the reasons is because, you know, we can sort of, if we go back, pretend it's 2009 and we didn't make the investments into acquisition or into cultivation and stewardship, right, you wouldn't see, for example, $7 million. All of those donors you acquired in that year has resulted in X amount of dollars. You wouldn't have seen that. Right. So that's a great metric to show your board to be able to move them to that next level.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I get that question too. And I get it, you know, from CEOs and EDs that I've worked directly with. And I got it from clients when I was consulting years ago, right? What should I show the board? I'm big on showing, I hate to keep harping on this, but I'm big on showing the board your data hygiene and your data quality, you know, because the board is going, we need more events, or we need more this, or we need to do more that, or we should get more major gifts. Okay, from whom? Mm-hmm. Because this is the reality of the world that we're living in. We have 15,000 records. Only 2,000 of them have ever given, or, you know, 3,000, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. These other 12,000 people in our database, who are they? They've indicated some affiliation with us. They're in our database for a reason. So before we go out looking for these amazing new people, these supposed mythical unicorn donors that exist out there, you're out fishing your own pond. Who are these others?
Right.
And showing that to the board of, we don't have the information to contact them, but who do you know? And let's connect them with them. This is where I really champion wealth intelligence and prospect research, because I really do think that you know, prospect research or wealth intelligence is seen as this, as the bastion for a capital campaign or major gift fundraising or all of that. And it is, it helps you define and get more information. It's not the tool, it is a tool in your arsenal. But when you screen a database and you find folks in your mid-range and low range that have some wealth indicator, it's not necessarily, hey, I can convert this $50 donor into a major gift person, but hey, it does tell me that there's capacity there that they're not giving to, and we can start to target upgrades and acquisition, right? You look at a large file, throw a screening on top of it, non-donors, hey, these folks that scored a little higher in the wealth intelligence, let's target these and see what the response rate is. Mm-hmm. So I did this. Mm-hmm. I just did this like 2 years ago, year and a half ago. Never givers, and ran a screening on them. Put them into an acquisition pack that was beautiful and perfect, and it was, again, I was pretty darn proud of it. Response rate was terrible, absolutely terrible. Less than like half a percentage.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it was a terrible response rate comparatively speaking. Average gift, $285.
Wow.
The ask string started at 25. 25, 50, 100, 250, right? $285 average gift. And more importantly, 62% of respondents chose a monthly gift.
That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, yeah, and the problem in selling that was the response was, oh, the response rate's terrible, right? It didn't break even. No, right. This didn't break even when you look at that first gift.
Right. But
62% of respondents chose a monthly gift on a credit card with no end date.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's power. There's a lot of power to these things.
Yeah.
And they're not hugely complex.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. Wow. You know, I always think about our data, and I think, you know, we worry about so many different aspects, and we should be worrying about different aspects of our organizations. But I often think sometimes the database is left to someone,
yes,
who maybe has an 18-month turnover. So, you know, you might start in a position and you're the database person, and you think that, you know, the MD code for monthly donors should be MD. And then, like, you know, I start in 18 months, I take over your position. I go, I'm really excited about monthly donors, so I'm going to make it MD exclamation mark. So there's no way to search that. And when we do our reports, we literally get pages and pages and pages of appeal codes, because no one has systematically sort of figured out how to organize that. So then you can't pull the data, right? It drives, that part drives me crazy.
We have institutional priorities for everything, right? Most organizations do. The programs are documented. You know what programs you offer in your mission. You know how to deliver them. There's expectations, there are outcomes, et cetera. There are HR manuals. We know how to manage staff, or at least what our policies are around. There are policy manuals for a lot of things. Rarely do I ever see a data policy manual. And it's data is your number one asset. This is where the value is, both with your current donors. Yeah, try calling a major gift donor by the wrong name. Send them a letter to the wrong address and see how long that relationship lasts with you, number one. But you never see these a database manual that sets the institutional priority of this is how we keep data, this is what's in the data, this is how we manage the data.
This is who can access the data.
Oh my gosh, don't even get me started. That's all, again, a whole other podcast.
Oh, so, I'm telling you. That's why I'm gray under all this blonde.
Oh, dude. I pulled my hair out. That's why I'm bald.
It's crazy. That part makes me absolutely nuts.
We may have to do a spinoff, you know? So like Simon Scriver's Ultimate Amazing Adjectival Podcast, right? You and I might have to do a spinoff like All in the Family, right? The Follically Challenged.
Yes, exactly.
Or something. I don't know.
No, why I'm 48, but I look 92. Yeah. Oh, heavens to Betsy. I, you know, when I think about, you know, people coming to me, the other thing too, is I always have people sort of in hushed tones after they work with me and, you know, to sort of say they want to do one, they'll say to me really quietly, our data is really horrible. And in the same tone, I go back to them, don't worry, everybody else's is too. Everyone's so worried that theirs isn't perfect, so then they tend not to want to do anything with it. So
or they're daunted by what they think is difficult, and this is why I tell the algebra story. It's not hard. It just requires a little TLC. But I hear this so often, we don't have time. We don't have time to focus and manage the data. I'm sorry, but you do have time to go out chasing other donors.
Right.
You do have time to sit in strategy sessions about who you're going to find.
Right.
You make the time and you prioritize the time. So I think it's about how we value data. Look at all the podcasts, look at all of the blog posts, look at all of the recommendations that we get from so many great and wonderful thought leaders. How often, it's why I love that you and I talk about this, because how often do we see real tried and true, like deep into here's what you should do with data in a way that's accessible, in a way that you get a lot of, and this algorithm and X over Y and blah, and I tune out, right? So, you prioritize the things that are important to you and valuable to you, and being truly donor-centered. If we all agree, and I think we do as an industry, right? If we all agree that being donor-centered is the thing that we should be doing, I mean, donors are data, so paying attention to that data is being donor-centered. And Sam, the longer I go, the more I do this, the more I am convinced there is an ethical responsibility on the part of fundraisers to manage data well.
Absolutely.
And that not doing so, we're skirting our ethical responsibilities to manage donors. And here's what I mean by this. So I'm going to give more information than anybody wants or needs, and somebody's going to write it down and go, we're going to find them. So T. Clay Buck, right, is how I list everything. Always have. Always gone by my middle name my whole life. It's just a family tradition, whatever. My full name is Thomas Clay Buck, right? My first name is Thomas. Nobody's ever called me Thomas. Nobody knows me. Do I look like? I don't even look
like. You do not look like a Thomas.
I know. So whenever I have to fill out something official, right, I have to put that first name. Especially with credit cards, because that's how it's listed on a credit card. Sam, do you know how many renewal solicitations I get addressed to Dear Thomas? Mm-hmm. Because regardless of what I put on the form, somebody will enter the credit card processing, they enter the name Thomas, and then that's what gets entered into the CRM. Mm-hmm. One organization I supported for years, who I just loved, and no matter what they did, I was that donor. No matter what they did, I kept giving. And finally, after about the fifth or sixth time of saying, guys, stop calling me Thomas, change the name, I stopped giving. And I wonder how many donors actually do that. We don't get their name right. We don't get their address right, and they stop giving because they think we don't know them.
I think it's a really good point, because as much as data is really important, we can't treat donors like data.
There you go. Yes.
Right?
Oh, I love it.
So yeah. Yes, data is important, but we can't treat them like data. We have to treat them like people. So making a request like that would be the priority, because you're just keeping a donor happy. And that, like, that's stewardship 101. So that piece really concerns me, that someone wouldn't just take something, really a relatively simple request, and they can even make a note, please note, or use, if you're using Razor's Edge, they're going to use that annotate, and it's going to pop up and say, this client, you know, his credit card says Thomas, but he likes to be called Clay.
Right, right. Yeah. Yes, yes. And there's a million ways to do it if you prioritize it, because it also, to me, speaks to institutional priority.
Absolutely.
You know, if your frontline person, the person who's answering the call, the person who's opening the mail or doing the data entry, isn't empowered to make those decisions and isn't thinking of those things, that's the first line of customer/donor service. Who is the, I love it. You've seen Simon talk when he does the whole dial a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I think the same thing is true for when data arrives, right? So whether it's online, somebody makes a gift online, or they sign up for a newsletter online, or they send in a check in the mail, whatever it is, whatever that data point where somebody arrives to the organization, is that front-facing staff trained and encouraged? Is donor centricity talked about? Do we have internal discussions about, hey, the donor is number one, right? And when they call, we go into full service mode. And I don't think we do, especially from a database perspective, and especially when, there's multiple reasons for it, I don't question the need for it, when the data entry clerk is a first-time employee and has no context for it, you know, so often the training is, okay, here's how you do it, here's how you just get it in, blah, blah, blah. I had one data entry person tell me, oh, I just, whatever's on the check, that's what I put.
Right. In.
Well, did you look at the response form? Because they told you something on the response form. There's 1,000, you said it best. There's 1,000 ways that donors talk to us through the data.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's do some rapid fire questions.
Okay, fine.
You ready?
Yeah, sure.
Favorite fundraising blog?
This is supposed to be rapid fire. That's not fair. There's so many. There's so many good ones. The Veritas Group.
Veritas Group, yeah.
I love them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And who's your favorite fundraising speaker?
Simon, of course.
Simon, of course.
Now, and I have a little man crush on Jen Love, though, so yeah, I have to admit.
It's fantastic. Yeah, Jen Love is fantastic. And favorite memory with a donor?
Okay, that's not a rapid fire, but can I tell this story really quickly?
Yeah.
Okay, so I went to an event, right? I was the, whatever my title was, I was the development person. So I go to this donor stewardship event and, you know, schmooze, do the thing, right? I'm looking fantastic. My game is on. And I see this woman standing in a corner and she's kind of not interacting or whatever. And I go over and talk to her and introduce myself, and she introduces herself and she goes, Clay, I'm not sure why I'm here. And I did the standard, oh, because we just wanted to show how much we appreciate you and thank you. You've done so much and blah, blah. She goes, no, I've been talking with everybody else in this room. And I see the recognition. They all give it like $2,500. And I just give $25. So long story short, whoever pulled the invite list pulled it wrong. She technically should not have been invited because it was a recognition event for that group at $2,500 above. Well, so she and I get to talking, and I, you know, just reassured her, and absolutely, she was welcome, and we were thrilled to see her, and she says, I wish I could do more. Now, sometimes donors will say that, and it's just a throwaway, and sometimes they're serious, and I got the feeling from her that she was serious, and I said, well, what you do is enough, and it's wonderful, and we appreciate it, and thank you. I said, if you are really serious about it, have you ever considered giving $25 a quarter? I can do that? Oh, absolutely, you can do that. So she started giving $25 a quarter. And, you know, this is not a person who was high on my cultivation list, but because her name had come up for me, and then I'd see her periodically or hear from her periodically, long story short, at the end of a couple of years, she was actually giving $250 a quarter.
Amazing.
And it's just, it was just a simple thing. It was a data accident, but we turned it into a happy one because then we could tell her that she could do more. And again, data, I think we forget that there are real people on the other side of that. And with real, and she really wanted to do more. And so we found a way to help her do that.
Fantastic. That's my favorite fundraising conference.
Nonprofit storytelling. I love it. Again, there's just I haven't been in a couple of years. There's just an energy to it. I'm a big fan of AFP Icon, and I really like AFP Icon too because so many people go, and it's the hallway conversations. It's the connections that you make while you're there.
Biggest mistake you've ever made in fundraising?
There are so many.
I know, me too.
Biggest mistake I've ever made in fundraising.
Can I tell you mine while you think of yours?
Yeah, please. No, do.
So I had this woman call me one time and she basically was probably, she sounded to me like she was about 40 and she asked for our legacy giving information. And I just didn't make it a priority. It kind of sat in my desk and I'm like, oh, I got to write that woman a letter and send this off to her. And I sort of waited a couple of weeks and I finally got to it and sent it off. Everything else seemed so much more important to me. Right.
Right.
So I, you know, eventually send it off and I make a note. And I always remember, I don't remember why I remember this, but I remember that I was to reach out to her after Labor Day. So I did, and she didn't call me back. And about 6 weeks later, we received, and I don't know if you've get those packages ever, but those big thick envelopes from a lawyer's office, and you know that there's a gift in there. Someone's passed away and left a gift in their will. And to my absolute shock, it was her. And she had brain cancer and she had left a gift for us. And what was really, really tragic about the whole thing was that when I looked up her file, and this is where, you know, a big, big lesson for me, and that's why I want to tell the story to the world, is that she had only given $25 at one time to the Wiggle Waggle Walkathon. You not?
I love the name.
She earned me over $750,000. And that was a shocker to me that I had potentially, you know, not fulfilled a donor's wishes, not moved quickly enough. I had judged because of her age. I had, you know, made other things priorities that clearly weren't priorities. I didn't, you know, I didn't do right by that donor. And I have seen that. Like, I tell that story at least a couple times a year to anyone that will listen, because I think it's a huge lesson that I'd like to share so that others don't make the same error.
Yeah, I hear you. That's a tough one. And I think you hit on it exactly. It's all of the missed opportunities when you didn't pick up the phone, when you didn't have the right information, you know. And I think of so many times where I've seen a very valuable donor that you just can't reach. You have no phone number, you have no address. And I think it happens everywhere and all the time. And it's simple things that can keep those things from happening.
Absolutely. Right?
The other side of that is you have great information and your data is pristine and perfect and wonderful, and you're not returning phone calls or
right. You
know, answering people, and that's a problem too.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you want to share any blunder you've made?
Well, it would tarnish my appearance of perfection.
So. I do think you're.
I mean, so I've been in fundraising since 1991. The list of errors and blunders and trip ups is, you know, monumental, but all of them are lessons. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. And that's how I see them too. And I recently attended and participated in a conference here in beautiful Canada, and it was in the western part of Canada.
Canada.
And it was in Saskatoon, and David Kravinchuk, who is the founder of that conference, asked us to do fundraising confessional.
Ooh.
And I got to be the person that people told their stories to. And, you know, there was a lot of brave people in that room that shared their stories of mistakes. I shared mine. There was a few people, Tom Ahern, of course, and Simon Joy, and John Lloyd, David Kravitschuk. Wow. They all came up and shared. And once again, I shared mine as well. And I think it was a really good opportunity for all of us to just be real. And, you know, because how I started it off is I said to them, listen, a lot of times, you know, people will go to these fundraising conferences because I've done it and I've sat in the audience and I've looked up to, you know, Simon and Tom and John and all those people and thought, oh, wow, like they're perfection. Mm-hmm. Reality is when people can be vulnerable, especially as fundraisers, and be honest with each other and say, you know what, not everything's been perfect. Not everything is.
No, it's true. Well.
Then then basically when we can start being honest with each other, it only benefits the sector as a whole. So in that vein was kind of this fundraising confessional we did, and I thought it was really well received. People loved the honesty and of course some of the jokes and all that kind of stuff. So, but it was lots of fun to do as well.
Nice. I like it. Yeah. I like it. We did a similar session at ICON back in April. So myself, Barbara Talisman, Carrie Kate Grebo, Ken Miller, Antonio, I'm going to mispronounce her last name, McCarr from Australia. She's amazing. Right. And it was, you didn't just say that. Fundraisers sharing the things that they've heard from boards, from other fundraisers, from the community at large, of just the shocking things that sort of, and it became a really good cathartic response, but then also turned into dialogue. Okay, how do we solve this? How do we change this? How do we make this different? And, you know, we're off topic of data here, but the nonprofit sector is not immune, you know, gender pay gap issues and Me Too issues and, I mean, all kinds of things. I was with a group in that session, and there just happened to be, just worked out a number of LGBT fundraisers in that group, all of whom, myself included, said, I've been asked to take off my wedding ring, not talk about my spouse, use non-gender specific pronouns. Yeah. You know, all of these kinds of things that we get as fundraisers, because we're so afraid of the donor, we're so afraid of that funding, you know. Mm-hmm. and I go to,
you know, when I always love you know, I started using these terms a few months ago, joyful giving and joyful getting.
Oh yeah.
Joyful giving, you know, basically making donors feel like this is, you know, they're making really great impact and all that good stuff, but joyful getting is that we're doing it from our hearts, we're doing it you know, in a way that is really authentic to us as well.
Yes. Authentic to us and authentic to our org.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
Because orgs have an identity, they have a culture, they have a, yeah. Anyway, wow.
I know this is.
And everything else.
I know. This is kind of like, it's kind of a bit of everything today. And I'm so glad we talked about data, and because that's really what brought us together in this relationship.
Yes.
But I think the other things we've talked about today, I know will hopefully move someone else's mission closer and have let them be brave and share something maybe that they've done that they're not so proud of to help someone too.
I hope so. Speaking of brave, I think Simon was brave to, you know, hand this over to us. And look at us. We kept it professional.
I know.
And relevant and appropriate. Right. Right? We did all the adult things.
And we won't tell anybody that I'm wearing my jammies. Oh, I just did.
You just did. Yes. Oh. Everybody knows this now.
Shoot.
Oh, well.
That's okay. It has been my absolute pleasure.
Mine too. Thank you, Sam. And thanks, Simon.
I absolutely. And thank you, Simon. And for both of you, I always leave a better person after spending time with each and every one of you. And I adore you. And where can we find you, Clay? If they want to find you, where can we find you?
Mostly on Twitter, much to the chagrin of everybody in my life. Like, shut Twitter down for a second. Mostly on Twitter, at TClayBuck. I do a little bit of blogging at theannualfundlab.com, annualfundlab.com. But yeah.
Excellent. People can find me at sam@samlaprad.com. They can find me, of course, on Twitter, usually, you know, commenting on something you're doing. and of course, on LinkedIn and all those good things. So yeah. We encourage everyone to reach out to us if they have any questions. And once again, thank you, Simon, and we hope you enjoy your time away.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't, whatever, you're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hello, this is Morgan Freeman. For discounts on Simon's best-selling online fundraising courses, go to www.changefundraising.com/training and use coupon code podcast. Complete them in your own time, wherever you want. Get busy living or get busy buying.